It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A new variety of fast-growing tree is taking root in a Bayfield orchard. It's called Innova Tree, and researchers are testing its ability to remove harmful chemicals and heavy metals from soil and to quickly sequester carbon. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jeff Jackson is Extension Educator for the Natural Resources Research Institute at University of Minnesota Duluth. Jeff, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks so much for having me on the show today.
Good morning. Innova Tree making headlines on its ability to be good at removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. How does the Innova Tree compare to the average tree or other varieties?
Yeah, that's a great question. And before I answer that, I want to backtrack just a little bit to tell you about my role with University of Minnesota. And that'll tie into the story of Innova Tree and why we're using it for carbon capture. So I'm an extension educator, and I work with both the University of Minnesota Extension and the Natural Resources Research Institute, or NRI, in Duluth. And NRI is the applied research engine at the University of Minnesota focused on sustainable management of our natural resources. And NRI has a great partnership with Extension, which has the same focus, but from an educational point of view. So we're really excited about this tree, and my role is an educational role. But the tree itself that we've developed grows very quickly. It'll grow about 5 to 8 feet per year. And because of that, it's got tremendous potential to uptake carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. It'll uptake carbon about 4 times as fast as a red pine. And because of that, for a carbon market project, you would need a lot less land for that project. So that's just one of the potential future uses of this tree that we're exploring right now.
So growing 5 to 8 feet a year, how does that compare to the speed of growth of other trees?
It's quite a bit faster. And I'll say this is an improved variety of tree. NRI has a tree breeding program that has been working on poplars since the late 90s. And so they've gone through several rounds of improving this tree and bringing about the faster growth. But no, typical other trees are going to grow 1 to 2 feet a year. And so this is significantly faster than most other trees. So we've done extensive field trials with the tree throughout the upper Midwest, even into New York. And our comparisons are showing that compared to other hybrid poplars on the market, by volume, we grow 64% faster than the other poplar varieties on the market. And so our scientific team has really done a great job improving this tree in terms of growth and also disease resistance.
And I don't want to gloss over that the breeding program, I mean, this research has been nearly three decades in the making of cross-pollination. And I just can't imagine the time and patience it takes to create this type of new tree variety.
It is amazing. I joined this team 5 years ago as an educator, and I have great respect for the work that they've done. And one question that we've gotten from the public has been, so 30 years to develop one tree? And just to help round out the story a little bit more, this program started in Minnesota in the late 90s when there was a shortage of pulp for making paper. And the team turned to poplars as one of the fastest growing trees in the upper Midwest in the temperate zone. And they made tremendous improvements, and times have changed. And now there's no longer that need for pulp anymore. And so we're looking at more future uses of the tree. That's what NRI does. They look at future problems in our environment, in our economy, and how they can solve them. But the breeding program was extensive hands-on work, field trials, not only across the United States, but we have collaborators around the world.
Wow.
That are testing our trees to produce wood products for pollution cleanup. And we can go into detail on that.
We'll put a pin in that. Yes. Jeff Jackson with us, extension educator at University of Minnesota Duluth, as we talk about a new tree variety. And you can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Jeff, as we've been talking about the Innova tree, selective breeding here between Eastern cottonwoods and black poplar. Eastern cottonwoods native to Wisconsin, but black poplar non-native. Why use poplar species for the Innova tree?
Two things I would say. Poplar trees, well, this tree really was built for the upper Midwest and for the climate we have in Minnesota, Wisconsin, the upper Midwest. And poplar trees are just naturally one of the fastest growing trees in our climate zone. And so that was a good start to the program to start with fast growing trees to begin with. But they've got other qualities that make them work very well for industrial applications. They can be easily grown on poor quality agricultural land. And so they're amenable to industrial uses, raising them for pulp, paper, wood products, that type of thing. And a lot of trees don't work well in that type of setting.
What about linear plantings, like for windbreaks on farms? You just mentioned agricultural soil. What about windbreaks?
It's a great application. And we're working with folks at University of Wisconsin River Falls. I'll point to them as one of our partners. They are planting demonstration plots for windbreaks and other agroforestry practices. They began those demonstration projects this year. They're doing research, and so works excellent for windbreaks. There's so many uses for the tree. So for homeowners, it's quick shade and a wonderful privacy screen. Wildlife plantings on farms, they work well for windbreaks. Communities, we have collaborators with the USDA Forest Service that are using our hybrid poplar trees and other poplar trees for brownfield restoration in urban areas and urban reforestation.
Let's take a call now. Chris in Delavan. Chris, hi.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call. I was curious about whether or not any CRISPR technology is being used to, inject specifically identified traits into these like poplar trees, or if any kind of like genetic modification techniques are being utilized here. And that's it.
Chris, thank you. Genetic modification techniques, Jeff?
That's a great question, Chris. Thanks for calling in. And the answer is no. What we've done is traditional breeding techniques. And many of your listeners will be familiar with University of Minnesota apples and how delicious they are. We've developed this poplar variety tree in the same way. So it's traditional selective breeding techniques, very hands-on, but without any genetic modification.
And the nursery, the germplasm bank, has, I understand, hundreds of varieties archived there. What kind of repository is that for what has been produced in the Innova tree?
We actually have over 1,600 different varieties.
Oh, wow.
Archived.
Okay.
And many of these have been tested and field trialed, and many of them were still in the process of testing them and finding out what applications they're best for. The reason we brought Innova Tree to market, and I should point out to the listeners, the name we chose for the tree is Innova Tree to distinguish it from other poplar varieties in the market. We do have a patent pending on it, but it really was our best all-around dependable tree that worked well for homeowners as well as some other more future applications. And Innova Tree really rose to the top as the star of the family. And so that's the one we brought to market first.
Jeff Jackson is Extension Educator at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Be part of this conversation about new tree varieties and pollution remediation. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers in Duluth develop a new faster-growing tree variety that could address pollution cleanup, with sales of Innova Tree underway at an orchard in Bayfield. And we have Jeff Jackson to talk about it, Extension Educator at the University of Minnesota Duluth Natural Resources Research Institute. So the black poplar tree is non-native to Wisconsin, but white poplar tree is restricted, according to the DNR. Could the Innova tree become invasive?
That's a question we commonly get, and the answer is definitely not. And this is something I take very seriously. My last role before this, I worked in Wisconsin for a nonprofit, educating people to stop the spread of aquatic invasive species. Mm. And there's a few reasons that Innova tree cannot become invasive. So it does not sucker or grow from the roots like our native quaking aspen will. And it is eastern cottonwood crossed with European black poplar. The eastern cottonwood, so some people think of that. They think of fluffy stuff in the springtime. Uh-huh. Innova tree is a male tree, and so it has pollen, but no seeds, no fluffy stuff. But these types of poplar trees have been planted in the United States for over 75 years, and there's no evidence of them becoming invasive or spreading. And we have test sites going back 30 years. And again, when you go to those, you look at them, there's absolutely no spreading or escaping of these trees.
We heard from Greg in Middleton, called in to ask you if this tree is an option for producing fodder to feed small animals.
That is a great question, and I don't have the answer to that.
That's okay.
I don't have enough of an agricultural background to answer that, but I will research that.
As you look at its properties for helping the environment, the word phytoremediation tool comes up, and I know there's research underway there. What might this tree do for soil and other aspects of the environment?
There's a few qualities of this tree that make it ideal for phytoremediation, and that's a fancy term for cleaning up soil and water pollution, but these trees uptake a lot of water. And so an example project, and I'll point to, we've got a great partnership with the USDA Forest Service, and particularly about 10 sites in Wisconsin are active research sites for this. But a typical project might be a landfill that's close to a river. And so you plant a wide path or a wide area of our poplar trees between the landfill and the river. And the poplar trees will uptake toxins as they're flowing downhill towards the waterway and intercept them. And hybrid poplar will pull up organic and inorganic pollutants. They will pull up heavy metals. Some of the pollutants, the hybrid poplars, like some of the organic compounds, they will actually break them apart within the tree. Other ones can be stored, and such as heavy metals, and then safely disposed of later. But it's a growing field of research around the world, and we're really proud to have this partnership with the USDA Forest Service looking at these projects right here in Wisconsin.
I wonder if the research is looking at this tree variety's effects or possible effects with PFAS in our environment and breaking down forever chemicals.
I've heard that that's a topic of upcoming research.
Okay.
I don't think at this time they are currently looking at it, but that's a very intriguing area, and we definitely have it on our radar screen to begin some trials testing, looking at how well the trees uptake it and then what they do with it once they draw it into their systems.
That's exactly what Tom in Milwaukee is wondering about. What happens to these toxic chemicals these trees take into their system and other plants used in bioremediation?
Yeah, great question, Tom. And it depends on what chemical they're pulling out of the system. So some of the chemicals will be pulled up by the tree, and they'll actually go out the leaves unchanged and into the atmosphere. But that's a way of diluting these chemicals and pulling it out of a toxic site. Other chemicals will be metabolized by the tree, broken apart, and they're rendered harmless. And then some of the inorganics, as I mentioned, the heavy metals, when they'll be uptake by the tree, and then they'll just stay there in the tree. But so it's an inexpensive way of pulling them out of the soil, and then you can just deal with that. In fact, Kate, that brings up a really interesting corollary. I was contacted by a new startup company that had an interest in looking at our hybrid poplar trees for phytomining. So phytomining is pulling valuable metals out of the soil, doing it in a more environmentally friendly way. And there's a possible collaboration we have going there.
Interesting.
Possibly using our trees to pull valuable minerals and metals out of the soil.
Jeff Jackson with us, extension educator at the University of Minnesota Duluth, as we talk about a new tree species and take your questions, 800-642-1234. Jeff, Jill in Cross Plains called in to ask if this tree thrives in soil where walnut trees have been removed. And as fast as they grow, Jill asked, do they deplete soil of nutrients quickly as well?
Good questions, Jill. We haven't specifically done any trials where walnuts, and the concern with walnuts is they can put chemicals into the soil, which can impede the growth of trees that are planted later. We haven't specifically done any trials on that. We have done trials looking at nutrients, looking at fertilizer needs. In general, these trees do very well without fertilizer, and there isn't a concern with them pulling too many chemicals or minerals out of the soil and depleting it. That isn't a concern for our team.
What happens in the next phase of dispatching Innova Tree? How will people get it from orchards? Where will it be available? What's its trajectory?
We have a wonderful partnership with Hauser's Superior View Farm in Bayfield, Wisconsin. I'll just put in a little plug for them. I've made many visits there over the last few years. It is a beautiful apple orchard with a view of Lake Superior. And they've been evaluating it for 2 years, and they have brought it to market. So they're sold out for 2023. Next year, they'll be selling about 500 in 1 gallon pots. And so it'd be great if your listeners could check their website, Hauser's Superior View Farm. In October, they'll have that updated. and customers can place orders through the website on a first come, first served basis. And we are also working with four other nurseries in the upper Midwest. I've received nothing but positive feedback on the tree so far. And I think some of the other nurseries will begin offering it for sale in 2024. So please check our website. It's innovatree.umn.edu.
Well,
that'll be in the program notes.
Jeff, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Oh, we too. Jeff Jackson, Extension Educator, University of Minnesota, Duluth. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's Department of Transportation is moving forward with rebuilding part of Interstate 94 that runs through Milwaukee's west side. But as Jonah Chester reports, community members, environmentalists worry the project could undo years of efforts to clean up the Menominee River and safeguard neighborhoods along the expressway from flooding.
So what are we going to be doing here today?
We are watering.
We are watering the plant?
Yes.
It's community cleanup night at Milwaukee's Valley Park, and Ann Bowie is trying to wrangle about a half a dozen neighborhood kids. She's assigning them jobs for the evening. Some get mulching duty, some are in charge of watering the flowers. And she also deals with the occasional labor dispute. West of Valley Park runs the Menominee River. To its east is the valley, also known as Pigsville. And Interstate 94 forms the southern border of the neighborhood. Many Valley residents have lived in the shadow of the highway since this stretch of the road was built in 1963. Now the Wisconsin Department of Transportation plans to add two lanes to a 3.5-mile segment of the highway, and the valley falls right in the middle of that project. Bowie and her neighbors worry that expanding the road could disrupt their lives and pollute their community.
Look at these kids. There's like a 3-foot child there with a lung system that is already fragile and already probably compromised from living in houses with lead dust. So it's bad enough that we have the freeways that we have here, but why are we going to spend, 5 years probably building more?
The expansion of I-94 will add about 29 acres of asphalt to the road. That's more than 20 football fields worth of land that will no longer be able to absorb water. Neighborhoods along the highway, and especially those that are near the Menominee, have struggled with flooding in the past. Valley Park was actually built in the early 2000s to protect nearby homes when the Menominee floods. And residents say it's worked. Peggy Falsetti recalls a time when children would play in standing water when the Menominee River surged over its banks.
And things used to be different. I mean, I remember waking up one morning and the water was all the way up to 39th Street.
But other neighborhoods aren't as lucky. Many neighborhoods south of I-94 near the Menominee still face a high flood risk during severe storms. More households in those neighborhoods also face challenges like having older homes and lacking health insurance, things that make recovering from flooding harder. The State Transportation Department says expanding the road will increase runoff, but officials won't develop a plan to address that until the final planning stages. Cheryl Nen is with the Milwaukee Riverkeeper. She says their approach won't allow for community input.
There's been a lot of, really serious work to deal with flood management in the watershed, and that work continues. This type of a project, is going to make it harder for us to achieve our goals for clean rivers.
Milwaukee has its own rules for planning to minimize runoff in a project's early stages. But as a state agency, Nen says the Department of Transportation isn't bound by those rules.
It is frustrating because they acknowledge there's pollution. They acknowledge that there's a litany of different things they can do to minimize that or ameliorate those impacts, but they don't commit to anything.
The Wisconsin Department of Transportation declined an interview for this story. In an email, a department spokesperson said they try to minimize environmental impacts in all of their projects. Back at the Valley Park cleanup, Janet Haas says she's worried about how the expansion will impact the park. The community puts a lot of work into maintaining it, and residents think of it as the heart of the neighborhood.
Who is going to benefit? Because it's not going to be us. The soil is going to be crummier, more polluted. We worked on this park. Why should we give it back?
Haas says expanding the interstate closer to the park could undo all of their work. Jonah Chester, Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you can please show...
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Night sky watchers get a second chance this month to view a supermoon, the closest and brightest moon of the year. As the blue moon rises at the end of the month, call in with your question and comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Gene Creighton is director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. Gene, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. It's wonderful to be with you.
Good morning. So we're halfway through a streak of four supermoons in a row. Up next is the blue supermoon. How often does Wisconsin see a chain of supermoons like this?
It's not very common, but I mean, I think it's useful to realize what this all means, right? What is a supermoon? So the average, and I have to talk a little bit of numbers just to give context. The average distance between the moon and the Earth is about 238,000 miles. But that plays because the orbit of the moon isn't exactly circular. So at its closest, it can be 15,000 miles closer or farther than that, which means that when we say supermoon, the moon is like 6-7% closer than average, which makes it look bigger and brighter.
Aha.
And the brighter is even more pronounced, right? Because the brightness is like double, the effect is double because you have a full circle. So it can be up to 16% brighter.
So why is it blue when it doesn't look blue? Why is it called a blue supermoon?
That is an obvious question. Thank you for asking. Because as you point out, if anything, it's going to be red, not blue. So I'm not sure why blue is considered the strange color, but maybe because it really is a color that doesn't happen. The moon is called blue when it's the second full moon in a month. Mm-hmm. Or the fourth full moon in a season. So it has nothing to do with color, if you will, but it's just a way of saying it's rare. Mm-hmm. But even that, a blue moon happens every few years, 2-3 years.
What?
If you think about it, that's not surprising given that months are 30 days, 31 even sometimes, and the moon's period is like 29 days. So we squeeze in sometimes a second one.
What excites astronomers like you about supermoons, may I ask?
Anything that makes the public look up and say, "Ooh, that's a cool moon." Anything that makes people sort of connect with that, with the bigger cosmos, I think is very worthwhile.
What might a supermoon look like through the telescopes in your planetarium? I mean, what does that supermoon look like from your glimpse in the planetarium?
So the planetarium is indoors, and that moon is actually a fixed projector. Mm. The observatory, so if you look through a telescope, the fact of the matter is that a full moon is not the best moon to look at.
Okay.
And that's because with a telescope, because it's so bright, it's almost blinding. Like the telescope doesn't help you. So a full moon, I think, is best enjoyed without, you know, you don't need help with a full moon as beautiful as it is. A pair of binoculars is fine. But frankly, the best moon to look at would be a first quarter or even a crescent. And that's because you have better defined craters. So a moon like that can be really gorgeous, breathtaking, because it feels like it's so close. The sun's rays hit it at an angle, so you get some shadows and better contrast. So what you're looking at is more interesting visually.
as opposed to a full moon, which is just a big, bright thing that's a little blinding.
Beautiful, bright, yes. Well, let's turn our attention to meteor showers. The Perseids peaked last weekend. How long does the meteor shower typically last?
This one is a good one. Because it goes on for a few weeks, actually. So we can easily see more shooting stars in the next 5 or 6 days. And what's cool about that is we can predict when we're going to see these meteor showers because it's when the Earth goes through the orbit of a comet. And patient people, you need to be a little patient. You can see sometimes dozens an hour if you have a good horizon, like a big horizon, especially to the east.
Are there, you know, what causes the meteors that make up the Perseids?
Yeah, so we go through the orbit of a comet called Tuttle. Mm-hmm. And what happens here is that the debris, because a comet leaves behind, you can think of them as breadcrumbs. Those little pieces of rock or ice or some combination of both hits the atmosphere at about 40,000 miles an hour. And that is so fast that it experiences enough friction while it travels through the atmosphere where it slams in that it makes the air around it glow. And we see those quick streaks of light. And as I said, this particular meteor shower, we can get dozens an hour, whereas any time you can get just random meteors, you can get about 5 an hour.
Hmm.
But this is more spectacular.
Besides the Perseids, are there a lot of those debris fields out there?
There are, but you know what? In Wisconsin, this is by far and away the best.
Okay.
Because it's the time of year where the weather tends to be somewhat stable and it's pleasant to be outside at nighttime looking at the sky for long periods of time. There are other ones in November, December, but those are not good times for us. So I think if you're going to invest a little bit of time to see meteors, this was probably your best chance.
We've been thinking about you
anyway.
In Wisconsin. We've been thinking about you with the air quality situation around Canadian wildfires and just wondering how does wildfire smoke affect the night sky visibility?
So it's interesting because, of course, air quality is a concern for our health. It can make objects dimmer because there's more stuff in the atmosphere to travel through, right?
More particles.
But in some ways, yeah, but in some ways there's a, I hate to say a bonus, but in some ways it is, that because of all the extra particles in the atmosphere, things can look redder. So the sun, for example, some sunrises and sunsets can be very dramatic because there can be times when the sun literally looks red, even when it's not, you know, on the horizon. We expect to see sunrises and sunsets to be red when the sun is really low in the sky. But if the atmosphere is packed with too many particles, then the sun can look bright red even when it's high in the sky. I don't know if you've noticed that, but I saw that several times, especially when the air quality was particularly bad.
Yes, and we saw those pictures, posted on social media as well. We have astrophysicist Gene Creighton, who is director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. As we discuss stunning lunar displays this month, you can join the discussion along the way. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore supermoons as the moon nears its closest point to Earth, and we enjoy a big, bright lunar display again at the end of the month. You can be part of the conversation about the night sky. Call in with a question, a concern, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jean Creighton is director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee and stays with us. Jean, UW-Milwaukee calling this year the Year of Space. Why is this year in particular significant?
Well, thanks for asking, Kate. Yeah, so we have some really fun astronomical events coming up. So we have two solar eclipses, and one is on the 14th of October, and conveniently, it peaks at around noon local time on a Saturday. So, yay, everybody's out of school. And the weather, of course, is likely at that point to be good. So we're excited. We're excited about that opportunity. In fact, so much so that we decided over a year ago now to buy 10,000 solar eclipse glasses so that we could provide the community with opportunities to see the eclipse safely. I mean, I think it's important to reiterate that although it's wonderful to observe these phenomena where strategically the moon comes between us and the sun, it is very important to have proper protection because, as I've been told, our eye doctors can tell if you've been looking at the sun.
How long?
Your retina gets damaged. Yeah.
So on the 14th, of October, how long will people in Wisconsin be able to experience this eclipse? What might it be like?
Well, it is a partial and annular eclipse. So annular, remember how we talked about the distance of the moon changes over a period of time. If the moon is close to us, then it is big enough to cover the sun. But if it's at its farthest or farther away from average, then it looks smaller. So it's not quite able to cover the sun entirely. So even people who get to see the full extent of the eclipse, it's still an annular eclipse. So there'll be a little ring of the sun still uncovered. Definitely need eclipse glasses. So we will be providing them on the day. So everyone is welcome to come to UWM. Our event will begin at 11 o'clock on October 14th. And as we discussed before, I'd be very happy to talk about that closer to the time.
Sure, sure.
Second eclipse.
Oh, yes, go ahead with the second eclipse.
It's on April 8th. And to get two eclipses in the same school year is truly unheard of. I mean, lunar eclipses happen reasonably often, but solar eclipses are truly hard to come by. Again, we're not in what's called a path of fatality, so we're not going to get to see a total eclipse. But I think that even a partial eclipse is cool. It is a Monday morning, so we're calling it an eclipse breakfast. Mm-hmm. And we're hoping that our community will be able to kind of nip in and be able to take a look at the eclipse and maybe get some breakfast.
People do, make these, plan these eclipse trips. And I'm just wondering for the October one, what might be the best viewing location to travel to in the U.S. to see it?
So it's peaking south of us.
Okay.
So offhand, I would need to look at a map.
Sure.
But that's something that our listeners can easily get. If you just search for a path of totality for eclipse, it'll show you. The one is quite a bit further south from us. And the other one runs, I think, through Buffalo, like the April one. And I think places like Buffalo are getting a total eclipse in April. And you're right, some people do travel, but families, people who can't just pack up and leave when school is in session, you know, we get what we get. We get a partial eclipse.
Talking with Jean Creighton, director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. As we talk about astronomical events now and in the future, you can call in at 800-642-1234. Jean, in terms of the April eclipse, April 2024, NASA is planning to perform some experiments. What data can scientists get during a total eclipse that is otherwise unmeasurable?
Oh, yeah, great. So the sun is too bright, right? The sun, we talk about the different portions of the sun. So the part of the sun that's most visible to us is what we call the photosphere. And that's where light comes from. The word photos in Greek means light. But if you somehow were able to magically block that bright piece, then you see the eerie glow around the sun, which is called the chromosphere and the corona. Those areas of the sun are hard to study, and they're really hard to understand. And that's because what's weird about them is that the sun at the edge, if you will, is about 6,000 degrees or so. But then instead of getting cooler as you get farther from the sun, within maybe, you know, a diameter of the sun distance or so, the temperature gets to a million degrees.
Mm.
And we're not quite sure what is making the corona, that outer, if you will, glow, that halo of the sun, what powers it? What makes it that hot? So there's scientists who are trying to understand, you know, how the various aspects, the sun is a very dynamic body. How does that all work? How does the package, and it's embarrassing in some ways that the star closest to us, it leads us in this kind of basic way.
Has mysteries that we just can't quite solve. I want to make sure in our just last moments together, you have an astronaut visiting campus in October as well. Is that right?
That is right. Mae Jemison, who is not just an astronaut, I mean, as if it's just an astronaut, but she's also an engineer and a medical doctor. Mae Jemison, the first African-American woman in space, is coming to give a distinguished lecture series talk about her experiences in space on October 10th.
Oh, great.
And we're very excited about that.
Well, Jean, happy sky gazing. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the lovely conversation.
Jean Creighton, director of UW-Milwaukee's Manfred Olson Planetarium. This is title track of Neil Young's 1992 hit album, Harvest Moon. Next Harvest Moon, September 29th. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.